I'm going to begin recording. Okay, so we are going to start with the GL lecture. I hope everybody did have a chance to get it downloaded last night. I do find this very interesting, even more so than some of the other lectures I've taught. And so, an overview, the alimentary canal starts at the mouth, ends at the anus. So here's you a picture of that, just to give you a good idea. It refers to the elimination of waste through the intestines. GI disorder, yes ma'am? Oh, I'm not sharing my screen. Hang on 1 second now. Let me see, share screen. See if that gets it. Yeah. Okay, good. You're welcome. Thanks for telling me. On my way in today, I heard about an instructor that lectured for 2 hours on mute. I thought that would be me. Okay, so I'm glad we're not there. And how many do we have at home? Looks like a full house. All right, so this is representing GI disorders, and it does affect children of all ages. Most GI disorders in children are acute. They are not life-threatening. They are typically handled on an outpatient basis. And one primary concern, of course, is going to be our hydration status for these people. So the AMP, the GI role, is the absorption and digestion and elimination. The mouth is highly vascular. That puts children at a higher risk for infection because, of course, they share toys. They play in the dirt and they put everything in their mouth. Most of the foods they eat, if you think about that, they eat with their hands, right? So we have to always make sure and think about that. The esophagus, they frequently do experience GERD, and I do call it GERD, despite the fact that your book calls it GER. Stomach of the newborn is 10 to 20 milliliters at birth, and by 2 months old, it's 200 milliliters. By the time they're an adolescent, it is 3,000 milliliters. That's the max. Intestines are all present, but of course they're functionally immature. The biliary system is relatively large at birth. That puts them at risk for injury because their liver does extend past their rib cage, where ours ideally is completely covered by the ribs. Fluid balance. Let me see if my little guy will go here. No, I had my little guy going last night. Infants and small children have a higher amount of body water than adults do. They require more fluid intake, and they excrete higher amounts of fluid. That puts them at a real high risk for fluid loss. They rapidly lose lots of water when they're ill. It is just surprising when they have diarrhea, how heavy those diapers are and how often they're coming. So we always have to keep hydration in mind. They also have more insensible fluid loss. I'm good, thank you so much for checking. Yeah, I put the word out that I couldn't put me on the screen, so I had help on the way. Insensible fluid loss, we're talking about what you lose through your breath, okay? Our breath is very moist. Y'all have noticed that having to wear a mask, right? Also through sweat of the skin, even if you don't feel wet, okay? And it gives you the amount there that you would expect to see for temperature. So for every degree in temperature rise, you're going to lose more body fluid. The fluid loss through the skin is 2/3 of the total amount of fluid loss, and their body surface area is a lot bigger in comparison to an adult. Plus, their metabolic rate is a lot higher than it is in adulthood. Y'all think about as a young person how you were very easily made to maintain a lighter weight, and as you got older, working off calories got harder and harder. That's because the metabolism slows, so it starts out very fast in infancy.
Ms. Wood?
Yes, ma'am.
Would you change to presentation from your slide view?
Let me see. I'm not sure how to do that.
At the bottom, where the mm-hmm. little computer, where the little screen is. That way we won't see what's upcoming. And we can focus on you.
Slideshow.
No.
No.
Right by animation, here's
Somebody run up and show me. Click it. Ah, even better. All right.
Thank you.
Good deal. Thank you. All right. So our basic GI workup, we, of course, are going to check the chief complaint, the history of the present illness, past medical history, and of course, if they're an infant, maternal history is going to be important. We'll be asking about any kind of family history if we're suspecting a possible chronic condition. Growth and development, of course, is a concern. And then we'll also check on food allergies, because that is common in small children. On physical exam, and we're still talking generally, you're going to do the same thing in the same order that you typically do every exam you're going to do: inspection, auscultation, percussion, and palpation. So in looking at them, we're going to look at their skin color. We're going to try to decide, do they look pale? Are they jaundiced? Do they have icterus of their scleras? Or do they have any kind of bruising? And then, is the bruising in a typical spot where you would expect to see bruising? We're going to look at their hydration status. And of course, small infants don't always have tears when they cry, but if we would expect them to have tears, they do not. That's a good sign. We're going to look at their skin turgor, and where are we going to check that? Right here on the chest. We're going to look at their eyes. Sometimes babies will have very sunken looking eyes, and it happens very quickly. It's kind of towards the end stage, but when you see it, it's surprising. We will also use weight and INO as part of our evaluation process. We're going to feel their belly, and of course on the percussion, if it is solid, it will sound dull. Firmness in the belly typically is stool. There are several tests discussed on page 1509, 1510 in the book. The ultrasound, KUB, that's basically flat and erect abdominal x-ray. A barium test, liver function test. Stool, that's ova and parasites. Then you'll have a stool culture and EGD. So nursing analysis for hypovolemia. The risk factors are vomiting, diarrhea, and an insufficient intake. Oftentimes, if you have some of the GI going on, they're held NPO, and sometimes for close to 24 hours. The goal is to maintain adequate fluid volume, as evidenced by their turgor, the mucosa, tears, and an output of greater than, what y'all know this one, 1 milliliter per kilogram per hour. So IV fluids and oral rehydration solution, that's the ORS. Your book does say that you can only use the ORS for rehydration. I don't really agree with that. If you can get something in them, if it's a Sprite or salty chicken soup, that's going to make them thirsty. They're going to drink more, and you're going to have a little bit better cooperation if you're giving them what they prefer. But according to your book and according to what you're going to put on NCLEX answers, it is only ORS, okay? We do have to reintroduce a solid diet as soon as they can tolerate it. And that's because it's almost impossible to turn liquid into solid, right? So we do have to do that. And we will avoid easily absorbed carbs like sugary things and fruit juices, because that goes straight through the gut. If you think about it, when a baby's constipated, you give them apple juice to make them poop, right? So if we're giving them juice, we're perpetuating the diarrhea problem. We assess the hydration status, of course, through daily weights, and we discourage milk because milk is high in lactose, and lactose is just another form of sugar. All right, so on diarrhea, GI inflammation is usually involved. It is almost 100% of the time viral, okay? When you think about what are your other causes, it would be through maybe a bad food that they ate that sat out too long, or it would be from a water source, like a water well that has some contamination in it. Diarrhea usually has frequent liver stools. They have hyperactive bowel sounds, and they will have abdominal cramping. In infants, they will draw those legs up and kick, just straight out, draw them up and kick. The goal is to decrease diarrhea and have more formed stools. What you're going to do is give them a clear liquid diet, and it is less than 24 hours, and avoid milk. Brat diet, that's one of my favorites, y'all. Bananas, rice, applesauce, and toast, okay? And when you think about what is represented there, it is nothing but bland, starchy foods. So those are the more dense, harder to digest carbohydrates. It's hard to turn liquid to stool, so introduce those solids. So on constipation, that's our next topic. That is irregular defecation or a decrease in the stool frequency or volume. It usually is due to decreased motility, and sometimes it's due to having insufficient fiber or fluid in their diet or even their activity level. Now, that's unusual for a kid not to be active enough to induce stooling. But it's considered hard or hard to pass stools. Sometimes you can even palpate stool in the gut, and they will be dull to percussion because, remember, if you got a lot of stool, it's full. What we're going to do, we're going to examine, expecting that dullness. We're going to encourage fluids and meds if they need it. And the most commonly used one is Miralax. And you do use Miralax for quite a long time. Even once you have good stooling going on, it takes a long time, if the constipation has occurred over a long period of time, to remove all that extra stool from the gut. We are going to encourage activity. A very common complaint in school-agers, y'all, this is the number one thing that you see in a school-age kid coming in with abdominal pain. You almost know before you even start checking that it's going to be due to constipation, because they've developed modesty and they won't go when the urge hits. So the other thing is that most kids go to school, haven't had maybe a little bite to eat at the house, but they all have that free breakfast. And, you know, you have to walk right by the cafeteria to go to school. And so they all stop in there and have breakfast. And then 20 minutes later, where do you think hits? The urge to go. And then they're not going to go. So what do you think happens then? The brain just says, hey, I've told you to go a million times. You're not listening to me. So I'm not even going to bother telling you anymore, right? So that's how the constipation turns into a huge issue. So constipation typically is due to poor food choices. It sometimes can be due to an inability to ingest or digest the foods or absorb the nutrients. That's very rare. Some psychological disorders, we'll cover that in behavioral health. The goal is to maintain or gain weight. Weight loss is discouraged. If you want an overweight child to become a healthy weight, you might shoot for about a pound a month weight loss, but typically the height will catch up with their weight eventually, and that's our goal. So what you would do, encourage their favorite foods, enteral feedings if they need it, add calories to their diet, high quality, high calorie snacking, and limit calorie-free beverages. So we're talking about a lot of times people give them Diet Coke and stuff like that. We will consult a nutritionist if it's needed, and if they're underweight, they may need supplements. All right, so diarrhea is acidic. You know, you think about your gastric acid. That's a term that we're all familiar with. It is very acidic, and when you get sick, your proton pumps will pump out even more. The acidity of the diarrhea can cause really horrible diaper rash. When they get that diaper rash, you use a barrier cream. That's something that is, keeps liquid from penetrating. Instead of using wipes, you'll use a washcloth, and we'll leave the diaper open to air. Why on earth would this say respiratory considerations? It does. There are considerations. We saw this yesterday. Who were my students that saw the little girl breathing so shallow yesterday? We had an 8 or 10-year-old little girl yesterday that was breathing 34 breaths a minute because she had GI stuff going on. You know, her stomach was just killing her. She'd been vomiting repeatedly. And so what's your next concern? If they're going to breathe very shallow over a period of days while they're sick at their stomach, they can develop a respiratory infection, right? So you do have to consider that. So encourage turn, cough, and deep breathe every 2 hours. And then play games to encourage deep breathing. And then we can teach them how to splint if they're in pain, how to hold their belly when they need to cough or sneeze or, you know, get up and move around the room. So there are some respiratory concerns. Body image, bowel issues are very embarrassing. There's sometimes if they have to have a surgery, they have scars. And then occasionally you'll see a child that winds up with a colostomy bag or even just has a stoma. We do have to encourage them to accept the body changes and involve the child in the care of their sight. So it gives them a little bit of power. It gives them a little bit of control. It makes them feel a little bit more comfortable with it over time. Observe for coping mechanisms. And then we are going to acknowledge their feelings of denial at first and then anger. And as they work their way through the process of having a deal, we have to encourage that. Because sometimes if you wind up with a bag, it's for life. not always, but usually. Oral rehydration is discussed there on page 1513 of your book. Common GI drugs, the H2s, that would be like Pepcid. PPIs, the olds like omeprazole. Antibiotics, if it is bacterial. A stimulant, if they need that. Laxatives, if they need that. And antidiarrheals. The ostomy, we're going to treat it kind of like we would measuring the hat that goes in the commode. We're going to measure the output. We're going to evaluate it for blood or mucus. And believe it or not, you have to consider what does it smell like. And that sounds so gross, but you know, certain things have a certain smell. Rotavirus is one that has a very distinct smell. The stool is acidic, so we have to assess the stoma. Sometimes it'll get red and even broken down. The pouch needs changing about every 1 to 4 days. And then we have to encourage them to avoid tight clothing, especially in the area of that pouch. So let's move on to cleft lip and cleft palate, okay? And they are separate. They sometimes are seen together, but they can be seen individually. And you would think that palate couldn't be seen without the lip being involved, but it sometimes is. It's the most common craniofacial abnormality. It happens 1 in 700 live births worldwide. Usually it is an indication of something else wrong. And that would be something else genetic or something else that developed at the same time that the mouth developed in utero. That's about 30% of cases of cleft lip and palate have something else going on. There are heart defects, ear malformations, skeletal deformities, and GU abnormalities as well. The complications include fever, difficulty in speech, delayed speech, which also has an impact on their developmental level. And of course, if they have something else going on, that's going to impact their developmental level as well. And then they do have frequent otitis media. Can y'all think why that would be? They're difficult feeders, okay? And that milk just backs up in their ears sometimes because they get choked on it and everything else. They do have a difficulty forming a seal. Extra air goes in as they are swallowing, so they gag and choke a lot. There's nasal regurg to the milk sometimes. And they do get fatigued just from feeding to the point that it causes insufficient growth. There's our little picture. I knew I had one in there. They do have nasally delayed speech. Otitis media may lead to hearing loss, and that's because of all the ear infections that they do have. Development of the cleft occurs early in pregnancy, usually around 5 to 9 weeks. And, you know, if you're wanting to get pregnant and you're just, you know, counting the days on the calendar and everything, you typically know you're pregnant by then, but most people do not, unless that's their goal in life at the moment. They find out around 6 weeks to 8 weeks of pregnancy. 50% with a cleft lip also have the cleft palate. Either can occur independently, like we said, and craniofacial specialists repair the lip around 2 to 3 months. The palate is not repaired until 6 to 9 months, and the repair may improve the parent and infant bonding. Because it is hard to look at, you know, it's hard. That child is not the child that you dreamed of having, you know, and so there's a little bit of bonding issue that goes on with that. So on the health history, we are going to ask about maternal smoking. It puts them at a little bit higher risk. Any kind of prenatal infections that the mom had, okay? Advanced maternal age, and on the mom's part, if she took during the pregnancy, or especially early on, any kind of anticonvulsants, steroids, and they just said others. The way that you examine this, if you, and it is part of the newborn exam that you're gonna do, if that's the area of care that you work in, you have a gloved hand and you just put your hand inside their mouth. They are gonna immediately suck on your finger, but you just press on the palate and bring your finger forward. To see if you feel an indentation. And it will be midline most of the time, but you do kind of check, okay? And what you're gonna do, you may have to restrain the baby after surgery so that they don't rub against that lip. It's surprising how little control that they do have so far as the finger, but they can get that hand up there and rub immediately. We don't suction, of course. We don't use a spoon. We don't use a pacifier. And we try to do everything we can to prevent them from vigorously crying, okay? Breastfeeding sometimes is okay immediately because of the softness of the breast tissue that you can put, you know, you can form a seal around the baby's mouth. It does require frequent burping, and we're going to have to acknowledge that feeling of the mom, and that she may have some guilt, anger, sadness, and they do provide links in your book if you ever need to do that, but I'm sure you pick up that good old iPhone first, right? Okay. So, mechal diverticulum, this is something that happens in embryonic development, and it is an anomaly. There's a fibrous band of tissue that connects to the small intestines from the umbilicus. It causes bleeding, which can lead to anemia, and intestinal obstruction may occur. It is an obstruction that requires surgical correction. In these babies, you'll see distension of the abdomen. They will have hypoactive bowel sounds. They will need IV fluids because they probably will be completely MPO until surgery occurs, and then for a good period of time after surgery. So umbilical hernias, they usually spontaneously resolve. If it persists past 4 years old, they'll have to be repaired, or it'll be just a lifelong hernia that they have. Incarceration is possible. Y'all think about jail, incarceration. That means gut has come beyond the peritoneum and has gotten trapped out there. Once it gets trapped, what happens? The blood supply gets cut off and the tissue dies, and it turns into a major, major problem. Signs and symptoms of the incarceration are redness, firmness, and pain. So if you ever have the opportunity and you have a patient that has a hernia and you get them to strain and you can see this hernia bulge, wherever it is, since it's usually midline, of course it is, if it's umbilical, it'll be at the umbilicus. But if you have them strain and then you can press it back in, it'll go squish, 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 and it just squishes right back in. It's pretty good. Pretty cool. Try it if you get the chance. So it does happen more inguinal hernias now. So this is down in the groin. It happens more in boys than it does in girls. Prematurity is a risk factor. Surgical correction is required because it can cause bowel strangulation. You think about the role of gravity in this. If it's down low, everything's going to be sitting on that opening, and it causes more of a problem. Assess for a bulging mass low in the abdomen or groin. And it is more apparent when they're straight intercrine, of course, because they've got those tight muscles in their belly, and we can manually reduce it until we just can't anymore, okay? Dehydration. This can lead to shock. Early recognition is important. Risk for dehydration or diarrhea, vomiting, decreased oral intake, fever, of course, through that insensible fluid loss, DKA, which is our diabetes, and burns. So we'll assess their heart rate. What's going to happen in dehydration? It's going to really get going, right? So the heartbeat is very fast. The blood pressure, because the heart is beating very fast, goes up, right? We're going to check their turgor. We're going to check their fontanelles if they're little, the mucosa of their mouth. We're going to look at their eyes to see if it's sunken. Look at the color of their skin, their extremities, urine output, and weight. And what you're going to do is oral rehydration. That's much better than IV. But if you do have to do IV rehydration, it's 1 to 1.5 times maintenance rate. Remember, they are very susceptible to overhydration because of the same things that make them susceptible to dehydration. So that we have to really walk that line. And this is where monitoring your INO and your weight really comes into play. There's a chart, it's chart 42.1. I figured out, I think that the page numbers for the actual textbook and the book that's available online don't match up, but the chart numbers always do. So if you can find your charts when I give you a chart number and review that information. It does rule out all kind of clear liquids. Anything other than milk and juice really, in my opinion, is okay. Oh, no, little babies, they're going to have the Pedialyte, that kind of thing, the oral rehydration solutions that are made for an infant. But, you know, once they get up about 10, 12 months old and you're giving them sips of, you know, something like, you know, well, you wouldn't want juice, of course, but just a soft drink, and I'm thinking Sprite only, but it doesn't matter if you give them a sip of something else. So once they get older and they're drinking other things, if they want something that they typically drink, you do have to limit the amount of sugar. You know, a lot of times we're giving them the little hugs and the little juice boxes and things like that, and that's all out because it has too much sugar in it. Okay? Does that help a little bit? So vomiting, I told a story about my son that vomited the other day. I guess it was just yesterday. He had rotavirus, and he was about 5 or 6 years old, which is older. Most kids that have rotavirus are much younger than that. But so he had a lighter case, but it just persisted for 2 weeks. And I thought he was finally over. We were at McDonald's, and he was eating his hamburger, and I saw the look come over his face, and I thought, here it comes, you know. And the little cardboard box that the hamburger came in, I slid it over, and he threw up into the box, and I closed it. And he took another bite of his hamburger. So kids are not always bothered by vomiting as much as we think they are, and not as much as we are, you know. Nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea typically go hand in hand with a kid. If they're going to have one, they're going to have the other. And where does it start? High, and it goes low, okay? So you're going to see the vomiting before you see the diarrhea. With this disorder, just like any disorder, we're going to start with a chief complaint. We're going to get the history of the present illness. We're going to ask any kind of family history if we're suspecting something chronic. And we're going to go through the cold spa. Past medical history in this condition would be looking for any kind of pre-existing illnesses or conditions. If they have a GI disorder and then they suddenly come in with an acute onset of vomiting, we want to know, is it related to that disorder or is this something acute and new and different? If they've had any kind of trauma to their abdomen, if there's been any kind of drug use, exposure to any other kind of medications, and in infants, it's usually just because we overfeed them. Y'all think about, remember we talked about their belly is about 20 milliliters when they're born. So we're shooting for 2 ounces. Remember that? We had that on test number one, right? What do we expect to be able to feed them? If they fall asleep and they've had 1 ounce, what do? We wake them up because we want them to get that 2 ounces in. Part of that is the nutritional status, right? They need that. They need the fat that's in the formula or breast milk to produce or promote brain growth. But then also, we're kind of training their belly to take a little bit more because, you know, as they get older, they're going to have to take more and more to be able to meet their nutritional needs, okay? We have to ask about the onset and the progression of symptoms, and it's important to document that. So not just what you see right at that moment, but how did it start and how did it change over time? We'll check their hydration status. Typically, we do encourage gut rest. And in your book, it says 1 to 2 hours. I even had it on here. We typically used 4. Promethazine is not the best choice of medication for vomiting. We would use Zofran, right? Aldosterone. Because promethazine makes a child very, very sleepy. I've had 1 dose of promethazine in my life, and I slept for about 30 hours. And you have to think about the fact that a sleeping child cannot drink. So promethazine is your last choice. On diarrhea, we have the same concerns, and typically it is a viral cause. The care is going to be supportive. We don't try to stop the diarrhea. What we're trying to do is get the toxin that's causing the diarrhea out of the body. If it's chronic, that's where it persists more than 2 weeks. There's specific considerations, and that's in your book, and you see where that is. So what we want to ask is the number of stools, how frequent they're having that VM, the duration of symptoms, like did it start 3 hours ago or did it start 3 days ago? Is it a small amount that they have in each VM, or is it a large volume? Are they showing signs or complaining of any kind of pain or abdominal cramping? Are they still putting out a normal amount of urine? That's one of your biggest concerns, because what happens if they are losing all their fluid through their gut and they're not losing it through their kidneys, bladder, urine, then the kidneys become damaged. And we'll talk about that pretty extensively in GI, because you keep working your way one step forward or one step backwards wherever you are. And not putting out urine is a big deal for a child. We want to make sure that they do have at least a wet diaper every 8 hours. And y'all working up there at the floor, you'd be surprised how many children are admitted after a tonsil and adenoid. And they call that a TNA, tonsil and adenoid, a TNA. These kids go in for a TNA, they go home, and they're not drinking, and they show back up in, you know, less than 24 hours, and we have to admit them, we have to get an IV going, and then we sit there and do tea party and everything else, trying to get these kids to drink, and they just absolutely refuse. We also do want to know if they've had any kind of recent travel. Or do they drink from well water? Do they have farm animals? Do they attend daycare? And do they have a family history of similar symptoms? So are they the only one in the family that's sick, or is it every last Tom, Dick, or Harry that lives there? Okay. On diarrhea, we'll continue with that. The physical exam, any distress, always check the right lower quadrant. What's down there? What are we concerned about? Yay, appendix, okay. So we'll cover appendix specifically here in a minute, but you always want to check that because that can turn into a much bigger deal if it goes undetected. If they do have decreased tears, we're going to be concerned. The sunken orbits, if they have dry, sticky mucosa, you're going to look at their lips too. Their lips will be probably the first sign. They'll get cracks around, not just cracks, but they'll be just kind of fissures almost, you know, where you can see that their mouth is dry. If they're listless, somebody asked me the other day what lethargy is. If you could think about somebody that's just a limp, wet noodle, you know, and they just could care less if you dangle a toy in front of them, they're not going to reach for it. They're not going to express any interest. That's lethargy. That's kind of an end sign, and it's not good. And, of course, our skin tugger, we do not want to see tinting. We do check their stools. Have hypoactive bowel sounds if the diarrhea is from an obstruction. So we saw this a couple of weeks ago too, where a child had a dye study done and they had taken contrast and then they didn't clear the contrast from their body. And then the contrast created a mass in the 16-year-old girl's body, okay? And then that mass is blocking the passage of stools. But there's enough pressure there that stool is pushing its way around this mass, and it became complete incontinence in the 16-year-old girl. She was in diapers. And you know how humiliating that was. But her diarrhea was not true diarrhea. It was from an obstruction, and stool was passing around the obstruction. So we have to consider that that is a possibility. So if you have diarrhea in the presence of hypoactive bowel sounds, you know that that is not typical. And you have to be looking to see, do you think that there might be some type of blockage going on? And of course, at that point, you'd explore the history a little bit more. Hyperactive bowel sounds are typical of diarrhea or any kind of gastroenteritis because your gut's in high gear, right? So hyper. On diarrhea, the test that we want to look at, we would, of course, want to do a stool culture. Ova-assisted parasites, I accidentally put the OCP instead of ONP. But that is the commonly ordered test, is the OCP, ova-assisted parasites. We're, of course, going to look at their electrolyte levels. And the KUB, again, is that x-ray of the abdomen that's done flat and erect. Y'all know where it's called, why it's called a KUB? Kidneys, ureters, bladder. How they came up with that and decided that that was what you call a abdominal x-ray, I don't know. What you're going to do, you want to restore the fluid and electrolyte balance. We have to reintroduce the solids. Again, it's hard to turn liquid into solid in the gut. And that was my question. How do you know if they're better if you only give them liquids? Because they're going to continue to have liquid stools. So we have to convert it to solids in order to determine if they are responding to treatment. In teaching, we need to tell our parents if they need to know proper oral rehydration therapy. Okay, so thrush. This is something that you're going to very, very commonly see in infants. Past infancy, it's very rare. Who would you see it in? Oh, I feel like giving bonus points to somebody who'll tell me. You're going to see it in somebody that uses an inhaler that is a steroid inhaler. Okay, so the only people you see it in past infants truly is people that use steroids as a form of inhaler. Okay, so thrush is thick white patches that are in the mouth and they're on the lips. It's gross to look at. There's a great picture in your book that'll gross you out. It coats the tongue. And you can tell the difference in milk residue in the mouth and thrush because milk easily wipes away and thrush does not. You know, you can take your finger and kind of rub on it to see if it's going to come off. and thrush sticks. And like I said, it is very painful. So what does it do? It interferes with feeding, right? This is called oral candidiasis, which is the same germ that causes yeast infections and causes candidal diaper rash. It is yeast or fungal. There's an expression, you know, that all ducks are birds, but not all birds are ducks, okay? That's the same thing with yeast and fungus, okay? You can refer to it as either one and still be right. It does occur in the newborns and infants. There's occasionally an immunologic disorder that's present that's causing it, and what will we think of in that case is sugar, because sugar feeds yeast. Corticosteroid use, and if you're on antibiotics. It can be transmitted to the breast, which will cause an infection of the skin of the breast, and mom and baby can continually give it back and forth to each other. You can treat the breast with the same thing that you're putting in the baby's mouth. We'll talk about that in a second. It could also be found in the diaper area, like we said. So it is nystatin oral solution. So if we're putting this oral solution in the baby's mouth, what's going to happen to the baby's behind the diaper area? It's going to get better, right? So the way that you apply this in the mouth, I don't think I have this on here, so I'll stop and talk about that for a second. Let's talk about a couple of considerations. When you are feeding that baby, we always say that a baby doesn't need water, right? And they don't need water. We're not trying to give them water because they need it for hydration status. But if you have that baby and you're feeding them a milky solution, whether it's breast milk or a formula, it has lactose in it. Well, there's a few exceptions to that rule, you know, the lacto-free formulas. But they have that sugar. Sugar feeds yeast, right? So we have to get the source of sugar out of their mouth. So after you get through feeding an infant, you'll give them a couple of sips of water, if they have thrush, just to clear the milk from their mouth. So we're removing the source. When you get ready to put the nystatin in their mouth, you're going to use a, you know, the little baby washcloths that are actually very soft. You're going to get it wet with warm water, and you're going to just kind of rub inside that baby's mouth to remove as much of the top surface of that plaque in their mouth as possible, so that the medication, when you put it in their mouth, actually reaches the live yeast that's in their mouth, okay? It's only about 2 milliliters, and that's not very much at all. You can put it on the wash rag if you want to. You can put it on the tip of your finger, or you can use a Q-tip to apply this in the mouth. And it doesn't have a bad taste. I don't think I've ever tasted it. It smells great. It kind of smells like a banana. You just give them, like, let them suck on a bottle of water. Yeah. And so, and y'all have to consider this too, because you're only going to give them a couple of sips, and then you're going to set that water aside so that you can use it after you feed them the next time. You can't. Those nipples have to go into the dishwasher, and it has to have that setting where it, help me here with the word, sterilizes it. Okay. Because that nipple will still contain it. You think about, we talked about strep. When they have strep, you throw away your toothbrush or you boil it. I've never seen anybody boil a toothbrush. They're too cheap. But you have to get rid of that nipple so that the next time when you give them a sip of water, you're using a fresh nipple. Okay.
What was the question?
On the water, I'm trying to remember what the original question was.
How you give the water?
Oh, yeah. She was asking how we give them the water. You know, was it through a syringe in the side of the mouth, or this is just sips of water using a bottle, okay, and a regular nipple. So we do clear the mouth like we talked about. We assess for the diaper rash. And our parents don't always know the links, okay? So they might know that their baby has a diaper rash and have no idea that it's connected to what's going on in their mouth. Most of the time, they don't know anything's going on in the mouth either, unless it's really bad. And so you have to kind of carefully approach that. You don't want to make anyone feel like, you know, they should have known something or recognized what's going on. But if we do have to, we're going to use the nystatin. They make that in several different forms. There's cream and powder as well. So if you feel like you need to, you can always use a cream and powder, or one or the other in the diaper area. Diflucan is also available. And it's very handy dandy dosing because it's just once a day, but it has the potential for causing liver damage. And I have seen that. So we would, of course, want to establish that they have a healthy liver before we ever used it, and then 2 weeks later recheck and make sure that we didn't kill the liver. I just suggest that you don't use Diflucan. And like I said earlier, it is okay to put the cream to the breast, and it's still okay to go ahead and nurse. Okay, so geographic tone, y'all, that's one really thing that's really cool. Does anybody in here have it? If you don't mind, volunteer and say, I have it. Nobody has it here. Anybody down there? Anybody online? It's very interesting. If you were to take and look at a map that's kind of muted in color, and you see the land masses and the, you know, bodies of water, that's geography, right? You can see like this map. People will have that on their tongue, and it's really interesting when you see it. And it's not a sign of anything wrong. It's just interesting to see. Oral lesions of any kind, okay? So now we're moving on to oral lesions. They are painful, and they will interfere with feeding, no matter how old you are. You will see oral lesions in children, probably up to about 5 or 6 years old. I'm not going to test you on what age, but they'll have all kind of viral illnesses that will cause oral lesions in their mouth. It does interfere with the hydration status and electrolytes. We can use magic mouthwash to treat them. It is swish and swallow. We can teach them how to suck it off the upside down spoon. So you put the spoon in the solution and you put it upside down on your tongue and suck it off. Do the same thing. We used to use a lot of magic mouthwash in my clinic. It is used prior to meals so that they can eat. It is usually a combination for children of Tylenol, Benadryl, and Mylanta. The role of Mylanta is just to make it thick so that it can stay on the tongue. And it's a combination of 1 to 1 to 1. So do y'all get what that means? If it's a teaspoon, a teaspoon, a teaspoon, a half a cup, half a cup, half a cup. It's the equal amounts of each one. Sometimes they will also include lidocaine. This is only on an older child because in younger children, it does away with the gag reflex and they will aspirate. So pyloric stenosis, this is hypertrophied pyloric sphincter, which creates a gastric outlet obstruction. So what do you think happens? They vomit, right? 30 to 40% of all cases are in the firstborn child. Why that makes a difference, I have absolutely no idea. It happens by 3 to 6 weeks of life. Vomiting is very frequent and it is very forceful. It requires surgical intervention. Complications to this are rare. And our concerns, of course, they're in a nutritional status. Excuse me, this is a baby that has lost weight. They come in and that baby looks frail. They are very thin. Their skin is dry. And I mean, it looks like if you touch them, you're going to hurt them. So it is an olive-shaped mass in the right upper quadrant. It's actually almost kind of in the middle, but it says right upper. They do have weight loss. They will become dehydrated and experience a metabolic alkalosis. We will resume oral feeds after surgery in 1 to 2 days. And it does create a lot of fear in that mom because she took home what she thought was a completely healthy baby. And then here, a few weeks later, they're needing surgery. And like I said, that baby looks very frail at that moment. So there's a lot of fear. And intussusception, you've got a picmonic available to you on this. And it's a cool depiction of this. Somebody tell me what slide number we're on. How many? 32. Okay, I've tried to go slower today, so I'm going to have to speed up just a hair, okay? Intussusception is a telescoping of the bowel, okay? So think about a telescope and how you can, you know, bring it out and in. So this means that part of the bowel has telescoped back over part of the bowel, which creates what? A complete and utter obstruction, right? Toddlers will have this, 1 to 2 years old. It occasionally is associated with that Meckel's diverticulum that we already talked about. It can flare and fade and flare and fade. Usually when it happens and you have to do surgery. If there's a caveat to that. So it will wax and wane. A barium enema, and I said, oral, because we always did oral. And if you put oral solution that has barium in it, barium is very heavy, and as it makes its way through the gut, it straightens it back out, okay? So that usually fixes it. If that doesn't fix it, we do have to do surgery. Remember, in any illness, you're going to ask chief complaint, HPI, cold spa, and elicit a good history. This usually does have a sudden onset with intermittent crampy abdominal pain that is very severe. And they will have nausea, vomiting, and in the beginning, diarrhea. Pyloric stenosis are currant jelly stools. That's a Hallmark sign. Remember, Hallmark sign. If you see it, you know what you got. So the risk, completely idiopathic most of the time, or it can be related to CF, celiac disease. You'll palpate a sausage-shaped mass in the mid-upper abdomen. Of course, these are what I said, the Hallmark signs. The labs, white blood cells may be elevated. The electrolytes may be abnormal as well. Okay, so malrotation or volvulus. Y'all have a mental picture of this one. Picture a volcanic mountain, okay, with a hole in the top spewing, and there's a wine corkscrew over the top of it, you know, with a little corkscrew going down. And at the bottom, the picture is labeled mount volvulus, okay? So this, just think corkscrew, okay? So that's what it's going to look like. It is a twisting of the gut causing a malrotation. They have bilious vomiting. Abdominal pain, shocky symptoms, abdominal distension, because nothing's going anywhere, right? And more and more is building up. They will have bloody stools, and it occurs in the first few weeks of life. It does require surgical correction, and it's called a LAD procedure. Necrosis of the gut, death of the gut tissue, is very common. That will result in an ostomy. There's a lot of problems with parenteral coping. The KUB shows the corkscrew appearance of the twisted bowel. We have to consider IV fluids, IV antibiotics, decompression, which requires an NG tube. So appendicitis. This is an acute inflammation of the appendix. It is the most common cause of an emergent abdominal surgery in a child. It is due to a bacterial overgrowth. It usually comes from feces that has gotten kind of stuck over the part that excretes what it does into the gut. So it's usually related to feces. The type of the surgery depends on whether or not it's perforated or not at the point in time that it's discovered. Bacteria can spill into the peritoneum, and that would be called peritonitis. So if it ruptures, it's a big deal, a real big deal. And they'll be on antibiotics for as much as 2 weeks. So the presenting symptoms in this order, it usually starts out with vague abdominal pain that begins to localize and becomes significantly worse in that right lower quadrant. They'll have nausea, vomiting, and fever. And it says in your book that it's going to be low-grade fever, but if it does perforate, you're going to see a very high fever. They'll have a little bit of diarrhea, possibly some distension. Our diagnostics, I started using that word. I was saying lab or x-ray. Diagnostics, that's the whole gamut of what kind of test are you going to look at. That's your diagnostics. This would be an abdominal CT, a CBC, or a CRP. That's a C-reactive protein, CRP. They will have pain in the McBurney's point. There's a good picture of that in your book. They may also have rebound tenderness. That's meaning as you very gradually press on the belly and they kind of get used to the feel and you yank your fingers up off of their belly, they will grab their belly. They will do a full bend over. GERD versus GERD. We call it GERD. Everybody in the world calls it GERD, but your book calls it GERD. This is reflux. That is recurrent vomiting, spitting up, weight loss. They might have poor weight gain. They may have a chronic cough. Adults that have GERD have the chronic cough. Chronic cough is, GERD is the second cause of that in adults. It causes irritability. It can give them very bad breath. Y'all ever had, smelled a baby that had bad breath? It's very interesting. They smell like curdled milk, I guess, okay? They may have chronic sinus or ear infections. And you just think because there's constantly pressure and regurg going into their mouth and ears. Risk are prematurity or other gastrointestinal disorders. They will have passage of the gastric content back up into the esophagus. It's really a normal finding in infants and small children. It is not associated with any kind of milk allergy. That's not the cause of it. Everybody thinks when they have a spitting baby that they need to change the formula. Occasionally that will be done, but if that baby has great growth and development, so, you know, think about that. And when we talk about children, that's one of the biggest measures of what's going on with that child, is looking at growth and development. If they are continuing to put weight on at the expected rate, and they're a happy baby, it's not making them fussy or anything, we just leave them on the same formula and continue on. And it can be a normal finding in small children as well, but it typically does resolve by 12 to 18 months. It is mistaken for a food allergy. The lower esophageal sphincter relaxes, then the intra-abdominal pressure can force whatever's in the stomach up through the esophagus. And you think about what creates pressure in the belly, and that's going to be a cough, sneeze, laughing, or even just moving about, you know. And sometimes when we go to pick them up and everything, we put a little pressure on their belly, and that's how we wind up with that spit up on your shoulder all the time. So our stomach is very acidic. The pH level is about 4. Y'all know how I remember this. A comes before B in the alphabet, right? So we're talking acid base. So A is before B. So everything below 7 is acidic. Everything above 7 is base. So think about your bell curve. And here is your peak, okay? Acid base. Does that help? So acute life-threatening events. I'm not sure of their exact definition of that, but I think that they're talking about SIDS, okay? I was going to look at that this morning, but I didn't have time. But apnea can be associated with GERD, and apnea is typically what causes those acute life-threatening events. The treatment is conservative. It is positioning, elevating the head of the bed, burping that baby frequently. So about, you know, 10 to 20 minutes into the feeding, and then about 20 minutes after feeding. We'll keep the infant upright. It says greater than 3 minutes after eating. That should be 30. Sorry, I missed my zero. Smaller, more frequent feedings are good. Burping the baby regularly. And I put the little... it doesn't rhyme. What is it when you use the same word to begin a sentence or every word? Refuse wriggling, okay? It can cause tardive dyskinesia, and I've had it happen in 2 patients. You can use Pepcid and a PPI, one or the other, or in combination if you need it. The surgery for this, if they have to have it, is called a Nissen funduplication. They actually take and make a little loop at the top and almost like a purse string to keep it closed. So the physical exam, honestly, it's typically normal, but if they are underweight or malnourished and have a history of spitting, of course, we're going to consider that. You're going to auscultate the lungs, looking for adventitial breath sounds that are related to complications. Airway and esophagus touch on the inside, y'all. Here's my thought. You know, when we're learning all about the anatomy and physiology, we see like the fruit bowl where here's the distinct orange and here's the apple and everything has this airspace around it and it's sitting there. It's a nice pretty picture. We're not like that on the inside. Everything is sandwiched together, right? So when you have the esophagus and the trachea, they run parallel and they are touching. You get irritation of this tissue. What keeps it from making that tissue irritated? It's not much, okay? So you can get some irritation that passes through just because of location. And then two, their little esophagus and airways are so short that it can come up and move from one to the other very easily. So the diagnostic test on this is the upper GI, a pH probe, or an EGD. We will manage their fluid and electrolytes and nutrition. And of course, use CPR if they have an episode. And again, we talked about position, PUD, peptic ulcer disease. I said ditto. It's the same thing, except this one is caused by a particular bacteria. Ta-da! H. pylori. Okay, so if you have H. pylori, there is antibiotics that treat it, amoxicillin, clarithromycin, and omeprazole. That's called an amoxiclav pack in an adult, but in a child, we would use that in combination. It causes a potential GI bleed. They may have mild abdominal pain and just vague epigastric or periumbilical pain. There are dietary restrictions, and all that is not too hot temperature-wise and not too hot spicy-wise. We're going to avoid stress as well. The H. pylori rapid test can be done in a clinical setting, and you get answers within just minutes. And it's completely non-invasive. It's just a blood test. Well, I guess that's not completely non-invasive, but it's just a drop of blood. And you use this drop of blood to determine if they have H. pylori. once that test has become positive, that particular kind of test, because it just measures the markers in the blood, it'll be positive for life. So if they have a recurrence of something that mimics this, the only way to determine if it actually is from this is to do a biopsy of stomach tissue. Now, oftentimes what will happen is if they've had it and you know your test is worthless at that point and you suspect that it's occurring again, you'll just go ahead and treat with the same type of medications that you treated with the first time. And then you use the proof in the pudding. Who used that expression the other day? The proof is in the pudding. But then if they respond and they're completely better because of the medication you gave, then you know that that was what the episode was. Does that make sense? We treat asthma that way. You know, we treat ADD that way. Constipation and encopresis. That's just a fancy way of pooping your pants. Okay. So 30% of the pediatric population have this. School agers about this. And why is that? We talked about their modesty. Failure to achieve complete evacuation. So they might go, but they didn't get rid of everything that needed to go at the point in time that they pooped. The diagnosis requires two of the following over 1 month time. And there's your list there, but less than 3 BMs in a week's time, hard, painful stools, stool withholding. They have very little control of their lives, right? This is one thing that they can control, and they will. And so don't ever let it become a power struggle, because they're going to win that battle. So it could be the brain signal thing that we talked about earlier, where the brain just decides not to send the signal anymore because you quit listening. So encopresis is just pooping your pants after successful toilet training, which typically happens around 2 years old. Sometimes it's about 2.5, maybe 3. But we're talking about stooling in their clothing at around 4 to 5 years of age. The treatment on this is to increase the fiber in their diet, increase fluids, increase activity. But then we also have to do bowel training. Can y'all picture what that might be? Bowel training consists of using the gastrocolic reflex that we all have. Give them something to eat. 20 minutes later, you go and you have potty time. And you go, it sounds crazy, but you go in there and you take something to read or something to play with, and you sit them on the toilet and you sit down on the floor and you sit there and you set a timer, something visual that they can see, the hourglass, little tick, 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 egg timer, whatever you want to use. But you set the time for, 5 to 10 minutes, never more than 20, okay? But 5 to 10 minutes usually is plenty of time. You get in there, you get them sidetracked, talking about whatever's in the book or the little game that you're going to play with them, and it allows their bowels to do their thing, okay? So that's bowel training. And it might not work the first couple times you do it, but over a period of time, you use that gastrocolic reflex to kind of get things moving in the right direction. So the health history, we're going to look at any altered pattern in their stooling. Do they have pain with defecation? Do they complain of abdominal pain or cramping? Do they have a poor appetite? Which will happen. You know, you think about your gut just feels so full, you can't make yourself eat another bite, right? And then they may have leakage or swelling that's due to the constipation, just like our mass in our 16-year-old girl's belly. So sadly, consider sexual abuse that sometimes can cause this. And once again, this is control. So this is something that they can control. So you may see a regression, but then also that. So risk factors, family history of GI disorders, and did they have their first BM by the time they were 24 hours old? That's the meconium stool. They should have that. The physical exam, their abdomen may be distended or have palpable stool. The anus itself may have a fissure or a hemorrhoid. The abdomen will be dull to percussion because it's full. And it will most likely be hypoactive. You're going to have to really try to find a gurgle in there. Our diagnostics, abdominal x-ray. What you're going to do is Miralax and teaching those dietary and toileting habits. Like I said, power struggle is big with this. Make sure you involve psych if you need their help. Hirschsprung. I want you to think from birth. Hirschsprung from birth. Okay, because this will be a child that never once didn't have constipation. Hirschsprung from birth. It's one in 5,000. It does occur more often in boys. Everything that we talked about for constipation applies to this, except the constipation persists from birth At no time did they ever have a history of normal stool. It does require surgical intervention. They'll probably have, well, we talked about that, no meconium within 24 hours. And they definitely will have a distended belly, and it'll be very full, and they have a very poor appetite because of that full belly. So what causes Hirschsprung? Let me see if I have it here. No, it's not there. It's that the nerves fail to develop. You know, you have sensory nerves, you have motor nerves, you have mixed nerves. So the nerves of the last section of the gut fail to form. And so there's no innervation. There's nothing to tell it that you need to go, but we never get to that point. There's nothing to tell it to go when the pressure builds up. There's no motor muscle there or motor nerve there to tell it to go. Short bowel syndrome, everybody calls it short gut. This one's pretty horrible, y'all. So it is malabsorption. They have electrolyte losses, a B12 deficiency. They do require multiple vitamins and supplements. Y'all think about your ADE and K. It requires TPN, total parenteral nutrition. Where does that go? It goes to the vein, right? So we're completely bypassing the gut. We're completely bypassing the liver. The prognosis is good, is not good. Let's go on to inflammatory bowel disease. This is your Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. This is the IBD of children. The cause is unknown. It is an inflammatory response to an environmental antigen or a trigger most of the time. It may be due to exposure to some type of virus or bacteria. Like I said, they don't really know. Management and control of the inflammation by avoiding potential triggers, using antibiotics, immunosuppressants or immunomodulators. The history is abdominal cramping. This one has nighttime symptoms where they have to wake up and go poop because they feel like they're going to have diarrhea. They have fever, weight loss, poor growth, which causes a delay in sex development. And then ask about mucus or blood in the stool. You'll commonly hear reports of blood. This is a very painful condition, and they are very waif-like children. So they are very thin, small children, teach them nutritional management. They do need high protein, high carb, and that's just because they're not getting much out of what they put in, right? So we have to make sure it's good quality. Calories that are going in. They have frequent flares. They have a lot of school absences. Sometimes they wind up with ostomies. And they have lots of self-esteem issues. Like I said earlier, bathroom issues are very embarrassing. Celiac disease. When I say celiac, think gluten, okay? It happens in European kids. And when we say European kids, what are we talking about? We're just talking about white kids, European background. It is called celiac sprue. It is associated with any kind of grain, but most commonly wheat grain, which is what causes gluten. It damages the small intestine. The immunologic responses to the digestion of gluten is what's taking place. The villi, you know, the little teeny tiny hairs that are wiggling and sending everything in the right direction, cannot absorb the nutrients from the gut and put it into the bloodstream so that the liver can deal with it, right? And so they're not absorbing anything they're putting in, which means it's going to go straight through the gut. If you go to a completely gluten-free diet, the villi heal and they function completely normally. You can't do it kind of partway. It has to be 100% gluten-free. You go back to gluten, the problems return. You get off the gluten, the problems are gone, okay? And that is for life, which is very hard for a lot of people to deal with, you know, and they will cheat, and then they're never successful in getting rid of it. So it does cause diarrhea, steatorrhea, that's just your really stinky stool, constipation, failure to thrive, and abdominal distension. They have poor muscle tone and delayed puberty. They have no butt. Y'all, there's a great picture in your book. They've got this big old Buddha-looking belly and no butt. And their arms and legs are skinny, okay? So that's what those celiac kids look like. They have wasted extremities. The tests that they use, IgA and genetics, the management, education is specifically targeted at helping them understand their diet. I said, this one don't play, y'all, and it doesn't. Functional abdominal pain, it is very common. The etiology is unclear. Multifactorial regulatory factors are at play in here. we do try to identify what their triggers are and avoid them. It is transient. It's usually peri-umbilical. It happens in school agers. And we have to just kind of identify what their stressors are. They do appear mildly in pain, and we have to teach coping skills, because this is something that they're going to live with for a period of time, because there's not really anything that we can put our finger on and say this is the cause. There's not really anything we can put our finger on and say this is a cure, right? So we teach them how to live with it, avoid the triggers if we can. Pancreatitis is something that's covered in your book. It is something that is so very rarely seen. I hate to spend much time on it. The patients that you might expect to see it in are who? Y'all know this. CF, right? It can be others, but CF is who you're going to commonly see it in. It may be acute or chronic. It causes abdominal trauma. It can be related to drugs. It can be attributed to a trauma to the abdomen. Drugs, alcohol, IBD, lupus, that's your SLE. It may be related to a viral infection, like cytomegalovirus, hepatitis. Most commonly occurring hepatitis in a kid's going to be B, because they ate something that was contaminated, right? There's a huge strawberry hepatitis outbreak in Houston a few years back. My sister-in-law wound up with that. Or any kind of obstruction. So that's where your CF comes into play, because, you know, they've got the production, but they can't move it. So it can also be related to gallstones. So there are just so many different potential causes. That's why I kind of does that clear things up, because it really doesn't help a whole lot to list that off. But they will have to be NPO now, okay? This is not something you can fool around with either. You're going to look for serial amylase and lipase levels, liver function test, epigastric pain, and it is severe. They will have vomiting and fever as well. And pancreatitis, they will have elevated leukocytes, glucose irregularities, meaning it can go high and low, because your pancreas is really the mechanism that manages your sugar. You know, it knows when to put out more, it knows when to back off and, you know, let you have the sugar that you have. CRP, that's your C-reactive protein. They will have the abdominal tenderness, distension, jaundice, and they may have blueness around their umbilicus from a hemorrhage. I've never seen that. If there's any bleeding in the belly, it's going to be blue. Y'all just remember that. That's something that's just a little catchphrase. If there's bleeding in the belly, it's going to be blue. Your management is going to be your IV fluids, pain management, and then restart the PO when it's tolerated. So gallbladder disease, you won't see this either, and I won't be putting it on the test, but a quick review just in case you need it down the road. It's associated with hyperlipidemia, obesity, pregnancy, birth control pill use, or CF. It happens more in females. Anything that obstructs the bile causes inflammation. It requires surgical removal. It's in the right upper quadrant, and it causes pain. It radiates into the shoulder or even the back. Nausea, vomiting with jaundice and fever, NPO, IV fluid, and NG tube to decompress. Got it? We'll move on. Biliary atresia. This is an absence of some or all of the biliary ducts, restricting bile flow. The etiology is unknown. They will do an exploratory laparotomy. If they need surgery, the surgery is called a Kasai procedure. They do eventually require a liver transplant, and our vitamins, again, are A, D, E, and K. Hepatitis. This is liver inflammation. The etiology varies. It can be from all those different sources, viral, bacterial, metabolic, chemical, toxin, or trauma. There is also the form called autoimmune hepatitis. It is chronic, and that's usually in females. It causes hepatosplenomegaly, jaundice, fever, fatigue, right upper quadrant abdominal pain. The treatment for this is rest, hydration, nutrition, corticosteroid immunosuppressants, and eventually they will also have to have a liver transplant. We will ask if they had a recent trip, especially out of the country, any kind of sick contacts, any kind of medication, drug, or alcohol use, risky sex activity, because remember, this can be transmitted in that way, or if they have had a blood transfusion. Our diagnostics, we look at liver enzymes, ammonia levels, PT, PTT, viral studies, and the management here is rest, hydration, and nutrition. Cirrhosis and portal hypertension. Destruction of the liver cells takes place, which causes scarring. That scarred liver tissue never regenerates, which causes further complications. And for some reason, this is associated with gynecomastia in males. That's enlarged breast tissue. Portal hypertension. So pressure between the liver and the heart as it returns. The pressure there, not all over, like the pressure in the blood veins that we would measure, blood pressure on the arm or the leg, it's not going to tell us anything there. The only way you can monitor that was an internal monitor. But it can lead to a GI bleed through what's called esophageal varices. Once they form, those are almost impossible to get rid of. Patients can die from bleeding out from esophageal varices. They will use vasopressive drugs, and they will also need a transplant. And that's it for that, y'all. So let me try to get out of here. Yes. Yeah, look at this. How cool. Slide 33. Here we go. You know, this is pyloric stenosis. And I see what you're talking about, the cramped jelly stools and the sausage shape. Let's review that, okay? And I'll send you an email. Later today, hopefully, on whether or not those two overlapped in my prep, okay? Because currant jelly stools and the sausage-shaped mass do go with intussusception. So I'm thinking, does it go with both? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we talked about the intussusception and sausage-shaped mass being intussusception yesterday. Currant jelly stools and yeah, so I'm glad you brought that up because I did mean to go back and take a look at that because in my mind I'm thinking, did I overlap those two? Did you have a question? No? All right, isn't let me see if I can get out of this.
Robin, isn't it an olive shaped mass with pyloric stenosis?
It is an olive shaped mass. Mm-hmm. Let me see here.
It's
so, okay, so here it is. Here's our pyloric stenosis. Then we moved on to the intussusception, and then it got labeled pyloric stenosis. That slide, number 33, is intussusception.
Yes.
Good deal. All right, so I'm sorry. Hope I didn't confuse anybody there. So we're going to go back now. We're going to pick up our GU lecture.